This hour, we will talk with the author of a book that explores two animal worlds. The one that our children experience with cartoon animals on their pajamas and in their books and on their TV shows, and the real one, the one that they will be inheriting, where half of all animal species could disappear before the end of the century. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's good to have you with us on this Monday, May 20th. Do you care that the polar bear, the whooping crane, or the Lang's metal mark butterfly could go extinct? Will threatened species be able to survive without human intervention? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. John Muhalem is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, author of the book Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people looking at animals in America. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why did you write about this particular topic? How did you end up writing about animals so much?
Right, yeah, it's sort of a weird story because I got interested in wild animals and basically this idea of wildness in America in general at a moment of real domesticity for me personally. It was right after my wife and I had our first child, a daughter named Isla. And, you know, instantaneously, like a lot of parents, I think we just instantaneously saw our house fill up with stuffed animals and polar bear pajamas and, you know, penguin sippy cups and rabbit bibs and all these representations of animals everywhere. And, you know, I didn't look at all these, this cutesy animal paraphernalia the way most parents probably do, because at the same time that this was happening, I was doing a lot of reporting for the New York Times Magazine about wildlife conservation. And, you know, I've always sort of been interested in animals, but it was always in a vicarious kind of way. I didn't have much direct experience with wildlife. I didn't even go hiking or camping that much. And so now at the same time I was seeing all of these adorable, wonderful animals in this peaceful animal world we show to our children, I was also learning a whole lot about just how dire and complicated the predicament of a lot of animal species is right now.
Yeah, so when you say that that you're looking at two different animal worlds here, that you know our kids have these polar bears on their pajamas, yet the polar bear faces extinction. And talk a little bit more about that and why we would even care.
Sure. I mean, I think the salient detail for me between these two images of animals, or the images of animals and then the reality, is just how different they are. You know, in when we think about animals, and I think I should also say, I think myself and probably a lot of adults, our idea of the animal kingdom out there is probably not so different from the idea that we're giving to our kids. I mean, I've always thought of wildlife as, you know, these grand creatures out there somewhere in the woods living autonomously, you know, happily going about their business. And in fact, the reality right now is that, you know, because we're causing so many extinctions, because our species has taken over so much of the planet and is exerting such an influence over nature, it's also up to us to keep these species intact. It's the ones that are surviving are there mostly because of our interventions and because we're doing a lot of hands-on work to kind of rig them in place. So it really contradicts this idea of wildness as something completely separate from us that I think a lot of us imagine.
Yeah. Give us an idea of how out of balance our Earth is in terms of how many species face extinction.
Sure. I mean, you mentioned at the top of the show, I mean, a lot of scientists will tell you that a good kind of back-of-the-envelope estimation is that about half of animal species could be gone by the end of the century. And basically, we've just disrupted so many natural ecological systems that now we have to manually override those systems and kind of run ecosystems on our own. So you get these fairly bizarre sounding, you know, projects that we're engaged in. I mean, right now in Northern California where I live, there's actually a project to shoot barred owls in forests so that we can make room for spotted owls. There are projects to monitor pygmy rabbits with military drones. There are projects to help salamanders cross highways on their migratory routes by picking them up in our hands and walking them across the street. Everywhere you look, once you scratch the surface, you realize just how involved human beings are in the survival of these other species and just how much help they actually need.
Yeah, so what would happen if we just left nature alone to correct itself? What would happen?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I don't think anyone can say. I mean, each case would be different. I'm sure in some cases the animals and the ecosystems would rebound eventually. But there are so many cases, and including some of the ones that I write about, where it's very clear that if we just walked away, these species would die out.
Yeah, talk about the three endangered species that you explored in the book.
Sure, yeah. The book is split into three parts, and each part is framed around the story of a different species, but more importantly, around individual people who have somehow involved themselves in the conservation of that species. The first is the polar bear, which, in the last 10 years especially, has become a real icon of climate change and is, for a lot of people, the first animal we think of when we think of things that may go extinct. The second is almost the polar opposite of the polar bear, species that probably most people haven't heard of, and in fact, fairly few people even care about. It's called the Lang's metal marked butterfly, and it lives on a little scrap of very industrialized land in between San Francisco and Sacramento. And the third is the whooping crane, which I'm sure people in Wisconsin probably know a deal about, mm-hmm. Because a lot of the most innovative work on that species is being done in Wisconsin.
And you ended up bringing your young daughter on some of these trips with you. Talk about that. Why did you take her?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think, in retrospect, I think part of it was just kind of wanting to call this bluff of I've had the thought, and I'm sure a lot of people have had the thought of isn't it going to be sad when there's no polar bears left on Earth, and my daughter's going to grow up in a world without polar bears. And I felt that very sincerely, but I could also step back and realize that there was really no rational reason why I should feel that way. It's not as if she has a lot of one-to-one personal relationships with polar bears, or she's not likely to see one. Why does that make me sad? And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to just actually take her out and show her some of these animals in the wild as a kind of counterbalance, maybe a more simple way of looking at these animals than we're prone to as adults.
And what do you think?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, what do you think she gained or took away from the experience?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, each case was different. Some trips she was much more she enjoyed much more than others. One of the interesting things was I think she gained a lot. I think I won't really be able to say that until she's a little bit older to realize the extent of it. But what was interesting for me was what I gained by having her along. Sometimes it just kind of kept me a little more grounded to just see a kind of childhood glee of seeing a polar bear and just being able to enjoy it that way, as opposed to all this baggage we've piled on that animal right now in terms of, our guilt about climate change. And also I found that when I was meeting people on these trips, whether Isla was there with me or just even explaining, that I would be taking her along, really opened up a different kind of conversation for a lot of people that, they knew I was going to be asking different questions and that my interest in these animals and the people working for them was a lot more emotional, than scientific at times.
So you also found yourself as fascinated by the people studying the species, the butterfly, the whooping crane, and the polar bear, as you were by the animals themselves. How come?
Yeah, and I should say it wasn't just people studying the species. For a book about wildlife and conservation, there are probably surprisingly few scientists in the book, although there are some. The people I met out there, a lot of them were amateurs. People who were just wanting to spend a day pulling weeds on this little piece of land to help the butterfly survive a little bit better, or tourists who were going up to a town in northern Manitoba to get a look at polar bears before they disappeared. Really what I found was you know, we all have these idiosyncratic and sometimes very imaginative relationships to animals, ones we see and ones we don't. And that was really what fascinated me was, you know, what kind of meanings do we attach to these animals, and what's our relationship to them? And also throughout history, I did a lot of historical research as well, just looking at the ways Americans have really thought about the animals that we've shared the landscape with over time.
Yeah, but some of the work being done by the professionals is extraordinary. The efforts that we will go to, for example, to save the whooping crane. For those not familiar with that story, share it with us.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the whooping crane is you know, it's a 5 foot tall white bird. It's the tallest bird in North America, and you know, even back to about the 1940s, there were only about 30 birds left on Earth. You know, for a variety of reasons. One of them was just, you know, simple hunting. There's a lot of stories about hunters sort of proudly killing whooping cranes because they thought they looked too too pompous, or they didn't like the abrasive calling these birds did. So really, this species was backed into a corner, even 80 years ago. Now there's 300 whooping cranes, which is really a miraculous turnaround. But still, doesn't really put the species on solid footing for the long term. So really one of the most innovative wildlife conservation projects happening right now is happening there in Wisconsin, where they've been able to build a second population of whooping cranes by breeding cranes in a lab in Maryland, in a government lab. And then they are teaching these birds to migrate from Wisconsin to Florida. Normally in the wild, a whooping crane would learn to migrate by following its parents, but these birds' parents are back in the lab in Maryland. So what they're doing is a nonprofit called Operation Migration, working with a huge partnership of other nonprofits and agencies, is training the birds to fly behind these small ultralight planes, which are basically hang gliders with what looks like a little amusement park car dangling underneath it. And they train the birds to fly behind these planes, and then they'll practice with them all summer in Wisconsin, and then they set out for Florida in the fall, stopping every 25 or 50 miles every night. And the interesting thing is that while they're doing this, they actually have to wear these kind of frumpy white costumes, mm-hmm. because they don't want the birds realizing that they're following a human being. They want the birds to think they're following another bird, or at least some undefinable creature, because they don't want the birds then set free in Florida to be very comfortable hanging around human beings. We want to preserve that wildness of the whooping crane so that they're, also just a matter of safety. We don't want these giant birds hanging around schoolyards. So this is, I think, an example of just how involved conservation work has gotten. We've got men dressed like birds teaching birds to fly.
So is there anything wrong with that?
Is there anything wrong with that? I don't think so. No, I think it's sort of wonderful. I mean, yes, it looks a little ridiculous, I guess, from the outside. I certainly had that experience at first, just being jarred by how bizarre this all seems. But after following a migration for a fall and really seeing, just how both hard the work is, and also really, how long-term of a project this is. I mean, this has been going on for 10 years already, and really it takes a phenomenal amount of energy and time and creativity to accomplish something like this. I think there's a real dignity to doing this, actually. I think that when you see just how difficult it is, and that these people are so dedicated that every morning they're, getting up at dawn and checking the wind and seeing whether they can fly another 25 miles, it really does, it left me at least feeling, pretty affirmed about our place in the world. Yes, we've destroyed a lot of beauty in the world, but here we are also working sort of ingeniously to repair a lot of that beauty as well.
We are talking with John Muhalem. He is the author of Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. Talking about the sometimes absurd modern conservation efforts that are underway today to save the millions of species on the brink of extinction. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue and another edition of Econ 101 after 3 o'clock. You can call in with your questions about the economy for our guest economist. That's this afternoon after 3. And tomorrow at this time, it's another edition of On Your Money. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley will be on hand to give you information and advice on managing your personal finances. That's On Your Money every Tuesday after 8. Right now, we're talking about our relationship with animals and our efforts to try to save threatened animals, and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, who is the author of the new book, Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. John Muhalem is a contributing writer to New York Times Magazine and author of Wild Ones. We have Gary in Boscobel joining us first. Hi, Gary.
Thank you, Joy. I wanted to thank John for his efforts. I've been involved with an organization called the Prairie Enthusiasts here in the Upper Midwest for about 30 years, and I understand very well when he talks about the struggle to save these endangered species. We focus on the tall grass prairie remnants that are left in the Upper Midwest, one of the most endangered ecosystems on the planet, and each one of these little sites that we have found, we have hundreds of volunteers, and these sites that we have found and purchased or leased and fight the endangered invasive species and all of the threats to these sites. And it seems like now the biggest threat that's growing is the process through which our agricultural community is going, where they're going to huge swaths of grain production and clearing more and more land to produce more and more grain, and it's tending to isolate a lot of these little prairie remnants pretty badly, and each remnant is basically a Noah's Ark of genetic information. And not
and
only plants,
Gary, but let me jump in. You're mainly interested in saving this tall grass, right?
Well, we're interested in the tall grass prairie community, which has anywhere from 50 to 100 species of plants, and for each plant species, some scientists believe we have as many as 10 species of insects. Our grassland birds in Wisconsin here are on the verge of disappearance, and the soil microorganisms which are found in these soils is not even inventoried or counted, and all of these species are rich genetic individuals, and nobody even knows what's there. And we're in a desperate struggle to save the bits and pieces that are left. And so anything that can happen that brings about public awareness of the plight of these species, and we're not talking about big things like polar bears, we're talking about tiny things, little bees that may be important pollinators if the honeybee disappears. So
right.
It's a low-profile operation. But
I'm just curious, Gary, what are you doing to try to save these prairies?
Well, we have chapters in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois, and each chapter focuses on a 2 or 3 county area. And within those areas, our members locate bits and pieces of tall grass prairie. Then we try to negotiate with landowners to purchase. And if that isn't possible, we will try to sign a land use agreement where we can actually go in and cut invasive trees and get rid of invasive non-native species and do management through fire and removing shade sources to allow these prairies to continue to survive and flourish. And then one important factor is to collect seed from these sites and propagate and use that seed to plant other prairies. And we have a large project west of Madison around Barneville and Ridgeway. It's I think it's about a 40,000-acre grassland bird habitat project going on with other organizations. So there is, within the ranks of the people who are compassionate about this, there's a lot going on, but the general public views this as something that's relatively unimportant.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gary, for calling in. And that's an interesting example, I think, John. Groups of people trying to save prairies because of the insects and the birds and the wildlife that those prairies support.
Right. It's really unbelievable listening to Gary talk. I mean, he's saying they've got hundreds of volunteers, essentially working to save these little bits of landscape. For some number of insects that they don't even know. I mean, that to me is an incredible ambition and an incredible piece of work. I mean, what he was saying, what struck me was he was talking about the way habitats like that can be essentially chopped up into little bits and pieces by either agriculture or, some kind of human use. And that makes preserving them even more difficult when they're disrupted. The butterfly that I write at length about in the book, the Lang's Betelmark, which lives on this one piece of land in California, it's basically surrounded on all sides. You know, there's a waste transfer station, there's a parking lot, there's a biker bar called the Red Caboose. It's just really hemmed in on all sides. And then right in the middle of this 67-acre piece of land is a wallboard factory, a giant manufacturing facility where they're bringing in gypsum and making wallboard. And in fact, they found that just having that plant there in the middle of the property has essentially split even this tiny piece of, this tiny fragment of butterfly habitat. It's now been split into again by this building because the butterflies can't go back and forth to mate with each other. So now you've really got the butterfly split into two separate populations. And that's a big problem with a lot of animals. Obviously, with things like butterflies and insects, it doesn't take much to split up a piece of habitat into lots of little pieces. With something like a cougar or a moose, it usually takes something a lot more significant, like a highway or even an entire town. But that's a real problem. This kind of habitat fragmentation that he's talking about.
And Gary mentioned that the general public isn't aware necessarily of the need for this effort that he and other volunteers are undergoing, and maybe they're not aware and they don't think it's important. Is that a problem? We just don't understand the importance of something like prairie grass.
Sure, I mean I can't speak to the prairie grass example in particular, just because I don't know too much about it. But I mean, I can argue that all of these kinds of restorations are important. I mean, a lot of them may not be. A lot of them may be, at least from the scientific point of view. I mean, I think that there's, it's hard to get excited about saving some kind of insect you've never heard of. I think that's understandable. Mm-hmm. I completely understand that. I think what's important to recognize is that basically, our empathy and our imagination is now a real ecological force. So these animals are reliant on our empathy for their survival and on the stories we tell about them and on the way that we understand or misunderstand or ignore their place on Earth. When you talk to butterfly conservationists, they all say, it's so difficult. Who's going to care about a butterfly when you can be, giving your money to save pandas or polar bears or whatever it is. And then you talk to the, American burying beetle conservationists and they say, these butterfly guys, they get all the attention. So there's these kinds of scales of charisma. And these things really do end up having an ecological effect. The animals that are going to survive are the ones that we pay attention to and the ones that we rally behind.
Do you think people are concerned, as concerned as they should be about wildlife conservation?
In my experience, in just talking to ordinary people in different parts of the country, I mean, I think that people are, there's a sort of baseline of empathy that people have. In general, people will appreciate the value of having other animals around, whether it's just, maybe it's a practical value that, as Gary was saying, that these bees are pollinating our food, or maybe it's just an aesthetic value You know, it's nice to know there's bears out there somewhere. You know, maybe not in my backyard, but it's nice to know that they exist. I think when it gets more complicated is because a lot of this recovery work has become so elaborate, and it's actually, you know, there's clashes of human needs in places and animal needs, and that the, you know, it becomes a legal battle or a property rights battle. It becomes politicized. You know, that's where it's easy to stop caring. But I think, you know, when I really, you know, a lot of the book is just really, you know, very personal stories about people coming to care about wildlife in their own idiosyncratic ways. And I think that, you know, just as human beings, we're sort of programmed to exist in a world surrounded by animals. And I think that it's understandable that there's a kind of, you know, a deep, maybe a deep and quiet sadness that can come over you when you think about, you know, just so many of these things disappearing.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with John Muhalem, who is the author of Wild Ones. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions about wildlife conservation efforts to save threatened species. Are you involved in one of these efforts? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Tim on Facebook writes, most animals in the wild don't survive very long, and that would be the case regardless of human existence. I'm not sure I quite understand. I think he's saying that if humans were here or not, you know, animals in the wild aren't going to be surviving very long. Your thoughts on that, John?
Well, I guess he's maybe talking about individual animals, like an individual bear will live a certain number of years. I mean, I'm writing more about species, you know, as a whole, surviving or going extinct. I mean, I think it's true. I don't know if this is his point or not, but I think it's true that there are, you know, there's been millions upon millions upon millions of extinctions over time that had nothing to do with human beings. I mean, extinction is part of nature. You know, I'm not denying that. And that's why, you know, like I said, I can't really say that, you know, each and every species, you know, needs to be, have 100%, you know, have its survival be made 100% priority of the federal government in any way. You know, I think there are cases where maybe we've put our weight behind a species that probably would have gone extinct, you know, whether human beings were around or not. And that really presents some problems. You know, that's really when you start to see that some of the empirical answers, you know, behind these conservation projects don't always make sense. You know, when you try to look at them from a strictly scientific or rational way, there's not always a real justification for what we're doing. Whether there is a kind of emotional justification or an aesthetic justification is another question. But just from a purely scientific point of view, extinction is fine. Extinction happens. It's these kinds of moral layers or emotional layers that we put on these extinctions that I find really fascinating.
Jacob in Burlington is with us now. Hello, Jacob.
Hi. Fascinating discussion. I'm wondering if the guest can comment at all on perhaps some of the relationship types of motivations or even spirituality that some people have who may be connected in these movements. And I'm coming from a Franciscan tradition, and Francis of Assisi in the 12th century wrote this Canticle of Creation where he related himself to the natural world as the brothers and sisters of the creatures. And I think it's an ethic that motivates me, but I, you know, wondering if you find similar types of things that people you talk to where we're really siblings to these other species and have to act accordingly.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a way, everyone's their own St. Francis of Assisi. You know, so many people I talk to kind of had their own very personal way of understanding their place in the world in relation to these animals. And I was really just trying to deal with their stories on a one-to-one basis, and it was a whole range of things. I mean, a woman who's breeding this butterfly in captivity right now in a lab in Southern California, she really got involved in all this when she was going through a divorce, and she's a single mother, and she just sort of wanted to prove to herself that she could throw herself into the project of breeding these butterflies and succeed as a kind of way of assuring herself that she was a capable person and that she was going to kind of battle her way out of this corner. One of the pilots for Operation Migration that's been working with the Whooping Cranes, you know, told me a really moving story about being a single father and trying to get his young son involved in being around birds and learning about animals, you know, sort of in the same way that I was interested in getting my daughter around them. And that was how he sort of fell backwards into being a guy dressed up in a white costume flying in front of Whooping Cranes. So I really think, you know, there are a lot of, kind of more intellectual or spiritual, ways of thinking about people and nature, like the caller's talking about. But I really think when it comes down to it, it's such a peculiar thing to imagine yourself as one creature in a world filled with other creatures, that everyone sort of finds their own way of making that make sense to them.
Anything else, Jacob?
No, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much. Emily in Madison emails, I'm an AmeriCorps volunteer at an elementary school where we teach kids about wildlife, both by reading and by talking to them, and by taking them to a marsh and other wildlife areas near our school. One third grade class is learning about endangered species. What would you tell these third graders about how they can best help endangered species? How can they stay up to date on environmental issues? John?
Sure. Well, I guess I'd say, if you're a third grader, the most important thing that you can be doing is just noticing things around you and just kind of building, a connection or a passion to other living things. Call me cynical. I think that I don't know that there's a whole lot that a third grader can do, out on their own to actually, help a lot of things. I suppose there's certain volunteering opportunities they could go, help pull weeds or count butterflies or something like that. But I think, one really interesting idea I encountered doing the reporting for the book was this idea of the extinction of experience, which is a term that a butterfly guy named Robert Michael Pyle came up with. And it basically just means that, if you live in a certain neighborhood and you see certain kinds of birds or, maybe raccoons or whatever it is that lives around you, that's sort of your ecosystem. And maybe those creatures aren't endangered, in a global way. But if those things start disappearing from the immediate area where you live, they may as well be extinct to you because you're not going to have the experience of living among them. And I really think that, I think with my own daughter too, I'm just, when we go on walks and things, I just try to help her notice different things around her. Because I want her to care about those things and to expect to live in a world that's filled with these kind of flashes of nature. Because if she doesn't notice those things, she's not going to be concerned about hearing that they're going away in other places. And she's not going to even notice when they start to go away around her.
We are talking about our relationship with animals and how we are trying to save these animals with the author of the book Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. And we welcome your thoughts and questions on saving the wild ones at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Stay tuned for talk about the top stories in politics. It's all things political coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with John Mualim. He is the author of Wild Ones, talking about conservation efforts and our relationship with animals, some of the innovative and weird conservation efforts that are underway today. And welcoming your thoughts and questions, welcoming whether or not you are involved in any sort of conservation effort to save the animals. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dick in Bark River says he recently read that there are at most 3,200 tigers left in the wild. And he says that that seems really low, and it frightens him. I don't know. Do you have a reaction to that, John? I mean, are we is the tiger going extinct?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the tigers are a pretty imperiled animal. The thing I find really interesting is that I've actually read there's far more tigers in captivity in the U.S. Than there are in the wild. So maybe the species will live on for a while in people's little home zoos or wherever who these people are that you read about who are keeping 16 tigers in their houses. That may be the last habitat for tigers in the world is somebody's backyard in Illinois.
Why did you end up choosing the three animals that you focus on in the book, the polar bear, the Lang's metal mark butterfly? And the whooping crane.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think first of all, I made a real conscious decision to only look at animals that live in North America. I mean, I was, I'm interested in animals, but I'm really much more interested in people, and I really wanted the book to be just as much, if not more, about the way animals have become a kind of cultural idea as opposed to just actual creatures walking around. And I felt like if I went and tried to write about giraffes in Africa or pandas in China, I really wouldn't be getting any of that kind of element. I don't understand those cultures. That's not where I live. So I really wanted to concentrate on animals here. And why did I pick those three? I don't know, actually. I think I was just sort of fortunate that the three of them turned out to have really involved and dramatic and interesting stories that led to a lot of other animals as well. I mean, there's a lot of sort of jumping off points in the stories of those animals where I'm able to tell stories about people involved with other species as well. But I did find it interesting that each one of those is sort of on a different point in this continuum of what's called conservation reliance, which basically just means, how much control we are having to take over the species. You've got the whooping crane, which, is sort of at the extreme where, we've really been a steward of that species, and it's been pretty dependent on us, going back 80, 90 years. The butterfly, where it's been, a few decades since we've had to kind of control its environment. And then the polar bear, we're just starting to think about, how are we going to protect this species, in a world where the climate is changing? I mean, there's debates about should we be feeding polar bears roadkill right now if they can't get on sea ice for long enough every year to eat seals? And a lot of these kind of philosophical discussions about how much control and how hands-on we want to be are just starting to happen around the polar bear.
And why do you say that? Why were you weirdly reassured after doing the book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's a hard point to put across, and I hope it comes across at the end of the book. I mean, I think that really, it's very easy to be worried, and it's very easy to be sort of shocked when you read about kind of how far it's all gone, and when you think about how far it might go, and what we'll be doing to protect animals in 50 years or 100 years, and eventually it's going to start to feel like maybe it's not worth it. But the weirdly reassuring part, I think, really came from being a lot closer to these people doing this work. From afar, when you're sort of sitting in your kitchen, reading the news, or holding your aluminum can and wondering, where should you recycle it, and does it even matter? It's easy to be overwhelmed by a lot of this worry. But when you're there on the ground, I mentioned before, just even being with these people working with the whooping cranes or whatever it is, when you're there, I really left a lot of these situations feeling kind of exhilarated. More is maybe possible than we thought. That there's a certain, I don't want to say even optimistic. Yes, I was optimistic at times, but it was really much more just a feeling of rightness. That here we are. We're just human beings are one species on this planet, and we're doing a lot to chip away at the beauty of the planet. But we're also doing a lot to sort of protect what we think of as beautiful here. And it feels good to be around people who are kind of in that fight and not just worry about it from the sidelines. And I what I'm trying to do is basically just take readers into some of these worlds and to try to give them that same feeling that I felt.
Our next caller is Sally in Green Bay. Hello, Sally.
Oh, hi there. Actually, I live up on the south shore of Lake Superior. I'm driving by Green Bay. But I just wanted to say, well, I'm really glad that you are out there trying to get people educated. And I work with wolf advocacy groups because our wolves are really being under attack right now in Wisconsin, all the Great Lake regions especially. And it's more than just, it's political. You've got legislators paying, or lobbyists paying back, lobbyists like the NRA and the Hunters Coalition. And a lot of that is what's got the whole wolf hunt even started. And basically, you know, it's so weird because I'll come down to the Milwaukee area and even discuss wolves, and you can tell people have like a blank look on their face. They're just so removed from what's even happening. But up by me, where I hear them howling, and I have to wonder if they're in a love trap. My Garmin's talking to me.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I get it, Sally. And I'm going to, in case John's not familiar with this, the wolf was, well, I'm sure you know that the wolf was delisted. But in any case, there is a hunting season now in Wisconsin for wolves, and a lot of people are upset. Obviously, some people are hunting them.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been following that a lot, actually, the situation all across the northern part of the country with wolves. And I think, you know, there's two things that I think are really interesting. One is, you know, back to this idea of that, you know, an animal's reputation really is key to, you know, how it's going to fare on the planet. I mean, the wolf is a perfect example. You know, look at all of the kind of psychic baggage we've piled on wolves. I mean, when you hear both ranchers and environmentalists talk about, you know, whether the wolf has a right to be in certain places, it's sort of funny at times to remember that we're just talking about this animal that really doesn't know, you know, anything about how we think about it. It's just kind of going about its business. But the other thing is that, you know, the wolves are a really good example of a kind of phenomenon I noticed in a lot of places with a lot of different creatures where, you know, we've really succeeded in bringing these populations back. And now that they're here, we sort of remember, well, you know, we're not really sure why we wanted them around in the first place. Some people, you know, don't really want wolves around. And how are we going to now coexist with them? And what are our plans for managing those populations? It's sort of jarring, you know, in a lot of these situations for me to realize that there wasn't really a vision of what would happen if we succeeded. The attempts to save these things can feel so desperate and defensive that you're really just trying to keep them from going extinct. You're not necessarily thinking about all, you know, the problems and arguments that might arise if they come back.
Yeah. Sally, thank you. Now we have lots of callers and little time, so let's go to Dana in Manitowoc. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to kind of point out that I think it's important for people to realize that the potential devastating effects of invasive species, and particularly feral pigs, cats, those kinds of things. And I'm not saying that we should eradicate these species or anything like that, but I think there are definitely some regulations that could be potentially put into place. It's just as if illegal for anybody to own a ferret that's not spayed or neutered in Wisconsin without a permit. We could potentially be putting some preventative legislation in place with cats and, you know, pigs that could potentially get out and breed and then hurt our native.
Yeah, Dana, I'm sorry, we have such a poor connection. What is the connection between, you know, feral pigs and saving endangered species?
Well, feral pigs could potentially have devastating effects on the wild species and native species in our state.
Yeah. John, what about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big issue right now. I mean, basically, there's a lot of conversations now about, you know, how should we think about all these invasive species that, you know, we have inadvertently or purposely, you know, moved around into different places where they didn't originally live. And yeah, clearly they're, you know, just tearing apart a lot of native ecosystems and a lot of this kind of natural machinery that used to run on its own. and you plop a feral pig down in a habitat where it's not supposed to be, and it's going to have huge ripple effects. I think the interesting question is, you know, in a lot of places there's, you know, maybe we're reaching or we've already reached a tipping point where, you know, the invasives, you know, the things that quote unquote don't belong there, are now so ingrained, on the landscape, that we may never really be able to eradicate them. You know, we may be looking at a kind of a hybrid, kind of nature now where it's sort of half the nature we inherited, mixed up with a bunch of other things that we ourselves did. And I think it just brings up a lot of kind of unanswerable questions right now about what exactly we're trying to preserve and what's possible.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you kind of save this animal or this species and eradicate this other one.
Right. You do get into a lot of kind of you know, one-to-one comparisons that are hard to make, but also just, you know, more broadly, the question of what's native and what belongs there and what doesn't belong there. You know, sometimes it's hard to judge. I mean, sometimes ecosystems have been changed so dramatically that they're sort of more robust and they're doing, you know, things right now on their own that we could never kind of simulate or bring them back to any kind of, you know, pristine kind of Eden that we'd like to imagine.
Patrick in Stevens Point is with us. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. How are you today?
Well, go ahead, Patrick. We're almost out of time.
Okay. I was just wanting to comment on the fact that throughout high school and a recent college graduate, I've noticed that, you know, the education on the environmental sciences and the natural resources is really lacking. I was fortunate enough to go to a high school with quite an extensive environmental science program, and I carried that over into my college career. But I've noticed that other schools throughout the nation, other universities, friends who go all over the country, they have nothing like environmental ethics, ecological economics, classes like that, that I believe don't just tie into the field of natural resources, but tie into every field across the board. And I was just wondering if, I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but where should the education start? I mean, at the high school level or younger, teaching about, you know, it's the only way to really change people's beliefs.
I get it. I guess, John, do we teach about this enough in our schools?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure I can speak to that. I don't know what curriculums are like, but I would just agree generally that, you know, I'm for education, more education about a lot of issues, and this is certainly one of them that seems to be, you know, especially depending on where you are in the country, there's a real dearth of understanding. So I agree.
Yeah. Well, in our final moments here, what's the takeaway for listeners or to readers of your book?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, it's, In a way, there's really no sort of straightforward answers at the end of my book. I mean, I think that this book and where we are right now in the reality of kind of our life on Earth with other animals is that we don't need more answers right now. There's a lot of books out there with pat answers about, you know, exactly, you know, what's important and why. And I think what I was more interested in doing is kind of scratching the surface of those ideas. And really kind of trying to just ask better questions. You know, what kind of world do we want to live in? You know, why do we think certain animals are more important than others? You know, are there any that really aren't important? I just really tried to move through these different journeys and meeting these different people, just trying to gather up a better understanding of how and why we have such deep feelings about animals, whether it's a deep fascination and a passion like some of the callers are talking about, or even a kind of revulsion, you know, the people who don't want wolves around. You know, there's something going on here, and I think it's really just an acknowledgement, you know, that we are human beings. We are a species living on a planet with a lot of other species, and the kind of imaginative and emotional bonds we share with them is a pretty fascinating terrain. One thing that I didn't really want to set out to try to figure out how we're supposed to fix this broken world that we live in, but, you know, really more just how can we live in the broken world, and how can we understand it better, and how can we teach our children about it and feel okay bringing them into it.
Appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being with us. John Mualim is author of Wild Ones. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.